Blog Talk Radio.
Future that lies ahead, one that will be here sooner than you think, and one that you have an important role to play in bringing about. The World Transformed, we want to introduce you to what may be the greatest transformation of them all, the one that begins with considering and acting on the almost limitless possibilities that lie ahead, and that ends somewhere beyond the reach of the human imagination. So, when does this amazing future begin? Well, today is the day. My name is Phil Bauermaster, and with me in the virtual studio is my co-blogger, co-futurist, and co-host. He hasn't changed a bit since the last time I saw him, Stephen Gordon. How you doing, Stephen?
Hey. I'm well, Phil. How about yourself?
Well, this is our big reunion show, I think. Huh? Actually, we're making a bigger deal out of this than there is. What did we miss? We really only missed one week.
Right.
But then we had missed a week prior to that. And the week that we didn't miss, we had the show on a funny day. So here it is, the 18th of June. And we haven't done a show since the 1st of June, right? That's
right, right. So
that's a long time for us.
Feel like it, yeah. Because we've been real faithful about doing a show a week forever, and somebody's got to be sick or completely out of pocket before we haven't had a show, and so this is it's been kind of a weird month. But anyway, we got a good one lined up tonight.
Well, we do, and we usually take a break in the summer, and I just want to announce that this was not it. Because we're going to take a break. Let me go ahead and get that out there. My family is going to be traveling to Malaysia, actually, in July. We're going to be going, so we're going to be gone from like the third week of July until almost the second week of August. So, Stephen, we'll have to put our heads together on what the show schedule will be, but I think we're going to miss at least two shows, maybe three shows we'll miss there, unless I can do one from there.
It would require you to be up in the middle of the night or for me to be up in the middle of the night. We might bank a show. We'll talk about that. That might
be there's all kinds of possibilities. Actually, it's not that bad. I think right now it's about 10:30 in the morning there, right?
Okay.
So,
it's not as bad as when you'll recall Philip Netterveld. I'm mispronouncing his name, I believe. But he had to get up at 3 in the morning one time to do a show with us from Europe.
Yeah. That guy's a trooper,
yeah.
Listen, I'll just tell you right now, I'm not doing that, okay? I'm not getting up at 3:30. And I'm the host.
So 10 in the morning is not so bad.
That might be doable. So we'll see if I can find a good place. We might have things going on. That's the only other thing, I'll just tell the family. Look, I know it's a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity, but I'm going to do my podcast, okay?
Exactly.
What kind of problem can I have with that? Jeez.
That's right.
So. Anyway, stay tuned for details on that summer hiatus coming up. But we're not on hiatus last week or tonight. We've just been, I've been traveling. That was the main thing. So we had a few days off, and a few things have happened in the meantime. I was actually at the Hadoop Summit last week in San Jose, California, put on by Hortonworks and Yahoo, and got to peek a little bit into the future of, for what it's worth, data management technologies. And I have a comment I want to make about this, because I've been in and out of the software business for quite a few years.
Since the 80s.
Yeah,
since the 80s, right?
I was talking to somebody about this the other day, and they said, how long have you been doing this? And I thought about it. I said, when was the first time I went to something like that? And I went to a Macworld Expo in 1987 in some professional capacity. So I've been doing that kind of stuff for almost 30 years. I've been doing that kind of stuff. And so I've seen it all. I mean, and Macworld Expo was awesome. I mean, you know, they would, there would be like these, in the middle of the Moscone Center in San Francisco, there'd be these like two-story booths, you know, from companies selling spreadsheets where they had like this big, you know, at that time, giant screen TV with Leonard Nimoy on there talking about their spreadsheet, and the whole place was done up like a starship. I mean, it was nuts. You know, I mean, it was just this convergence of like technology and marketing, and the world had never quite seen anything like it before, and it was a very exciting time. But that
over
kind of nonsense. What's that?
Over a spreadsheet.
Over a spreadsheet. Exactly. I mean, that was the beauty of it. Yeah. I mean, it's just like, right. That was what I was thinking. And I've thought that so many times over the years. You know, I'd be at Sybase events, you know, and the music would rise, and it'd be like, yeah, you know, great. Database and middleware software. Yeah. But I think I hit the pinnacle of it last week, actually, in San Jose. Because it was a great event. No criticism of Hortonworks or Yahoo or any of them, anybody participating. Fantastic event. But, you know, you show up in this San Jose Convention Center, and you go into the big ballroom or the big room, whatever it is. You know, there's this just beautiful graphic display up on the front podium. The lights come down. The music rises, right? And suddenly you're practically in a rock concert, okay? Then the lights go completely dark, and these dancers come out, and they're like, I guess they were like semi-finalists on America's Got Talent, and I'm sorry, I cannot remember the name of it. It's like Illuminate or something. I can't remember. But they're like lit up. So it looks like dancing robots on the stage, and they just appear to be like appearing and disappearing all over. I mean, it's just this, you know, Broadway or Las Vegas caliber show, right? And I mean, it's just the music and the whole thing. And I turned to the person next to me, and I said, wait, we're here to talk about a file system, right? Isn't that the, the Hadoop Summit? Anyway, it's just the hype in the software business is always it's an endlessly fun thing. I have to say,
it's funny. In a way, it's worth the hype in a way, because these unsexy things like spreadsheets and file management systems and everything else are changing the world. You know,
they are.
So in a way, it's funny, you know, and you know, to less, this is a little much for something like a spreadsheet, but you know,
yeah, you just think, wow, this is a bit over the top, isn't it? But no, it's not. Yeah. Everybody's really excited, and you know, what the heck? Why not? At that point you just kind of go with it. But anyway, it was a great few days. Anyway, was very glad to get back. Didn't get to any movies. But I understand maybe you got to see one of the big summer blockbusters last week.
Yeah, I did. I saw Jurassic World, and I saw it with a good bit of trepidation because my boys are big fans of the Jurassic Park movies. Okay, they, you know, they have their, you know, their favorite scenes that they talk about, and they, you know, the.
Yeah.
And, you know, I kind of liked the first one, and then, you know, my interest sort of waned as the movies progressed, you know.
Yeah, and, there's maybe one or two good scenes in each in the other two, but they're not, movies, they don't really hold up, in my opinion.
They, not really, but my kids are not that way. They loved all three of the movies. And then, you know, so very excited to see this fourth one, which is kind of a reboot, but really part of the same series kind of thing. And, you know, and so, you know, the critics did not come out for this thing. They didn't, you know,
they don't like it. Oh, okay. Panned
it was, you know, just only so with the critics.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I told my kids, now, don't expect much. So, you know, the critics, you know, are kind of lambasting it a little bit. And, you know, it's not like, 2% on Rotten Tomatoes or anything, but it's, you know, like 30 to 40% seemed like, somewhere in that range, you know. And you know, my kids were like, don't worry, critics don't know how to rate this stuff. They don't have a clue when it comes to movies like this.
And they are right.
You know,
they are right.
To a good extent, they are. Because, you know, if it's like some meaty docudrama that comes out in the fall that's Oscar bait, they know how to rate those things. But when it comes to summer blockbusters, they just, you know, they're not on board for that. Not the way, teenage boys are. They know.
Yeah, so
what, know,
what's the principal criticism? What are people saying that's wrong with it?
Oh, that it's a CGI fest, that it's...
good.
It's been a CGI fest from the beginning, guys.
Yeah,
I mean,
and
come on.
Now it's really good CGI, right? I mean...
Yeah, it's better
not that,
CGI
I mean, it seemed
before.
Amazing 20 years ago, but you can only
yeah,
imagine how
it
good
was
it is
amazing
now,
20
yeah.
years ago, but it's gotten better. And
yeah.
And so... and. Quite frankly, the critics got it all wrong. I have to agree
yeah.
with you. Know, that, you know, so my boys turned out to be right. We went and saw the movie, had a great time. It was there's some intense parts that you know I kind of you know I saw a couple of you know my youngest kids kind of hiding their eyes for a couple
yeah.
of intense parts. And you know there and so yeah. Other than that, there was you know nothing you know that I would you know warn families about too much. There you know. Chris Pratt is great, and you know you can see that it's almost like it'd be like this is his audition tape for Indiana Jones. Okay,
okay.
he can take this and turn it in and say, hey, I'm you know I'd like to take over the role now. He looks the part. He you know as an action hero, he plays a completely different role than he did in Guardians of the Galaxy.
Okay.
And so it turns out that this not just a goofy guy. This guy can act. You know, he's you know playing a completely different role. So and it was fun, just fun from beginning to end. And I don't want to give too many reasons away. You know, give too much away as to why it's fun, because that I think I'd be too much too many spoilers if I did. But I just say I would just tell everybody, yeah, if you've heard the critics and you think I'm gonna. You know, I'll just wait for it on DVD. Don't do that. You know, it's not the same on a little screen.
Okay.
Go see this thing. Yeah.
Well, we've been talking about it. If we can find a spare minute, we'll try to do that. Are there any characters from the original? Just curious.
Well, you
I
know,
just
some
wondered.
Very minor characters from the original.
Oh, okay.
You know, if you're a big fan of the series, my kids are pointing out, yeah, that guy right there, that scientist, yeah, he was in the original. You know, you know, but no, none of the big names are you know the leads are not the same at all. I was
okay.
a little disappointed. I could have you know, hey, where's Sam Neill? That he'd have been great. You know, as an older guy, that kind of you know that could, and then you know the Malcolm. Character would be interesting. You know, he could tell us.
Well, you would think there'd just be a cameo or something, right? You'd think there'd be some.
Right. It's like they decided. You know what? Let's, you know, let's not distract from the new blood by bringing in the old guys. Let's have a brand new movie. And of course, you can tell by the title that it's, you know, Jurassic World is the name of the park. Okay, this is
right.
This is like Disney World, but with dinosaurs. Okay,
right.
They so it's something that they've never had in any Jurassic Park movie before is an open park with actual
right.
people
yeah,
there
that,
enjoying
I mean,
the park.
That's
right?
The tagline, right, for the trailer,
yeah.
right? The park is open, right?
Yeah,
yeah,
the park is finally open. Well, and so you know, and mayhem ensues. I think you can
naturally
kind of
yeah.
gather that. So
what
but,
a spoiler!
But,
what are you saying?
Yeah,
it doesn't
I'm
all
sorry.
Go right.
It goes right all the way to the end.
Yeah.
So
almost
kind
of boring. Yeah, everybody has a great time in the end. Oh, yeah.
That's right. At any rate, it's...
sounds like a good movie.
Yeah, it's a good movie. So.
Awesome. Okay. Well, that's, you know, that's what's been going on in the neighborhood. Now, this was the thematic thing I came up with. I thought, well, you know what, I've got some stories that are set in space, and I got some stories that are set on Earth. So we'll just talk about news from the neighborhood, and I put a couple of pictures up on worldtransform.com. That is just a bunch of distant galaxies showing how big our neighborhood is. And over on blogtalkradio.com, that background picture that takes the place of the Earth that we usually show in the World Transformed is also just a cluster of galaxies. I think we're part of that group, that red one that you see there. Obviously, you can't see us because you know we're taking the picture, but that you know that's like it's called the Laikea group of galaxies or something. It's got a Hawaiian name, and that's what we're part of. this super group?
The local group is, I think, what they call that group of galaxies.
Well,
the local
group is a tiny subset of this thing called that, and then we're close to, you know, the next one over is like the Pegasus supergroup, and so anyway, that's a bit of our neighborhood too, and we're going to be talking about black holes a bit later. So we are gonna stretch it out here and get cosmic, but starting fairly close to home with San Jose and Jurassic World. Now we'll take a quick trip to Mars with this story. Tiny probes going to Mars. Stephen, did you check this out? This is quite interesting.
Yeah, it is. It's something that they've been looking at for a little while. It's a small 10 centimeter cube, 10 centimeters
right.
on each side, right? And and a cool thing about going small like this is if you are good enough at engineering, you can engineer a lot of punch in a very small package, and you can accomplish a lot with a very small probe. So, what are they talking about?
Really,
what do they want to do with these, Phil?
Well, one of the things you can do with them is you can create a whole communications network. It's like the easy, low cost way to create an all the way line of sight, all the way around a planet communications network. And I didn't realize these things called CubeSats have been deployed closer to home for some time. That actually we have them orbiting our planet right now. As you said, these 10 centimeter wide cubes, based on, this is really interesting, the size of a Beanie Baby box one of the inventors found in a shop. I guess he's like, he found this toy box and he's like,
that's about the right size to do something fun with.
this is about the size we want. And traditionally what they've been is there's some electronics and a solar collector, right? And you pop that thing right exactly where you want it, and, you're good to go. Now they're getting more sophisticated. For Mars, they're saying, well, these are actually going to be able to nudge themselves around, get themselves oriented, and, in fact, they'll even be able to move themselves into higher and lower orbits. So, these will be pretty well, souped up CubeSats, creating that network around the planet Mars.
It's interesting, Phil. One of the, Elon Musk was talking about some of the first things he wanted to do with Mars. One of the first things he said was, "Well, we need to set up the internet." And people laughed. And he said, "No, really. We need to do that. And there needs to be a huge information pipeline between the two planets."
Right.
And so I presume that this is part of the vision. Is that accurate? So I don't know if it's necessarily Musk's vision, but it's part of the vision of setting up, in a way, a network or an internet at Mars or around Mars.
It's really not that far-reaching. I mean, what it's going to be used for right now is some seismic research that they're doing on Mars. So this is going to they're going to coordinate geospatial stuff that you can do better by having four or five of these or however many of them out there than you would just by one satellite. But the idea of this is the way to create a line of sight communications network goes exactly in the direction that you're talking about, that you and Elon.
That would be a proof
right?
concept, right. wouldn't it? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. It's how you get it. It's how you get something like it started. And when you think about the fact that something that small can actually pack quite a bit of punch, can actually be a pretty useful thing in space. To me, this goes in a couple directions. Okay, this really gets my interest for more than one reason. And I hadn't even thought about putting the internet on Mars, but you're absolutely right. That's what that can do. It'd be a good way if we ever start settling the moon. These would be very useful for just ensuring planet-wide communication, or moon-wide, I should say, satellite-wide communication. Because people don't think about it, but if you're at point A on the moon and you don't have line of sight with point B on the moon, there's actually no way to communicate with somebody unless you got something else up there that's going to bounce the signal back, or unless you send a signal to Earth and then it comes back. That's not that big a deal on the moon, but it is a pretty big deal on Mars, because that's like a 40-minute round trip for the signal back to Earth, depending on how close or far apart Earth and Mars are at any one time. So you definitely want to have something self-contained as you're doing planetary, not so much exploration, although this is being used for exploration, but especially for like planetary settlement. But the other ideas I had, taking this idea and just elaborating on it a little bit, pushing it a little further along, I start to think, well, pretty soon we're going to have people putting their own stuff in space, right? I mean, that just follows the trajectory that we talk about, the human imperative and the capabilities passing into the hands of private individuals that used to belong to large governments. You know, we're getting closer and closer to the day when anybody who wants to can put something in space. And this will probably be the kind of thing people start with, I hope, right? Because if we're all putting massive things in space, that could get really dangerous and crowded. But you just think about, we've talked a little bit about kind of bootstrapped, from the ground up space programs that might be formed, kind of ad hoc by coalitions of people on Earth. This might be an important way of getting that going. It could also be a way of enabling communication among people where in regimes where it's blocked, right? It's like, well, we'll just put a CubeSat up there and, they might not be able to shoot it down, especially if we put like 20 of them up there or something like that. There's something very intriguing to me about the idea of that, something that small, almost disposable, although I'm sure they're very expensive to produce right now, that can make such a big difference. It's a right. tiny thing, but it's a tiny thing that has a lot of power to it. And the other thing this really puts me in mind of, the scenario we've talked about lots of times, is the Coke can Starship. This is not that. And to catch up anyone who has no idea what I'm talking about, we're talking about farther down the road, extremely advanced nanotechnology will allow us to create probes, interstellar probes, very small in size, that will contain enough computing power and enough basic machinery to enter another star system and just start building infrastructure, and also be completely full of, all the information you could want, probably contain a large population of artificially intelligent being, or, depending on how far in the future we are, uploaded human intelligence, or those might mean the same thing by then, but...
Yeah,
go
it's
ahead.
Full of stars, Bill. It's full of stars.
It's full of stars. Thank you. Exactly. Yeah. Just yeah. All, this kind of, little subset or almost replication of all of human civilization in a Coke can, right? Well, this isn't that, but you start to feel going like we're going in that direction when you talk about, a useful 10-inch cube, 10-centimeter wide cube.
10 centimeters,
Not 10 inches, 10 centimeters. That's, 6 inches. Just a little piece of something, but a little piece of something, I think, with a big future. Anyway, very interesting to see that those are going to be used in Mars, and I bet we're going to be seeing a lot more of them here in the neighborhood, too, in the near future. All right, what
Absolutely.
Else we got tonight?
A little closer to home, Phil. Hybrid airships. Now, I was visiting with my family, actually my mother and father. I was just saying, when I say hybrid airships, guys, what do y'all think I might be talking about? I just was curious. And, I thought, my mom was pretty close. She said, well, would that be like, an airplane that has like electric as well as a gasoline engine? Well, I thought that was a pretty good guess.
Yeah.
Good guess. But no, that's not what a hybrid airship is. A hybrid airship is like a dirigible or a blimp, but it's heavier than air. And you think, well, how in the world would it fly? Well, it's just slightly heavier than air. It's quite light because it's got lifting gas in it, but it's in an envelope that has enough of a wing shape that it creates lift as it moves forward through the air. And so it you get a lot of the benefits of an airplane, and a lot of the benefits of a blimp. It's a hybrid. It's sort of a sweet spot in a way. It allows very short field, short takeoff and landing. You don't need a huge long field, but to carry a lot of cargo, because you do require some runway, because you have to have forward motion or it will stall. It doesn't take much. And it'll carry a tremendous amount of cargo for a very low price, much lower priced transportation of goods than you would get with a cargo plane for certain. And so it's and is the you know and so it's not just a you know something on the drawing boards. There's some working models that have been made that you know are large enough to carry a single individual. Phil, and it's, I believe it's Lockheed Martin that's been pushing this, and I thought it was fascinating. I think it, I
think
would love
so
to see
cool.
this.
And it's cool that it's yeah. Lockheed Martin has put this concept video together. The link to the YouTube video is there on worldtransform.com and also at blogtalkradio.com. You can follow that link. It's a beautiful video, by the way. Speaking of the power of CGI, you know, they've created this computer-generated model of it, and they have it flying over Brazil, and they have it flying over, actually, Malaysia. One of the sites is actually flying right over Kuala Lumpur, and they're landing it in this Arctic landscape, and, I mean, it's just fun to watch, because this is a really cool idea for a vehicle. And people love the idea of airships. You know, the rigid airships that were doomed because of hydrogen, you know, especially with the Hindenburg tragedy, still capture the imagination. There's something really compelling about that idea. And here, as you said, you really do get the best of both worlds. Dirigibles and Zeppelins, those were, you know, rigid, lighter than aircraft. So that is a huge engineering feat to make something like that work. Here you've got, you know, it's almost a new category because it's heavier than air, but it's like you almost want to say slightly heavier than air, right? It's somewhat heavier than air, but it's not all that heavy. It's getting 80% of its thrust, I think you said, from the lifting gases, and then the other 20% of its lift, it's coming from the airplane style engines. And one of the things that I saw in discussion on this, I'm not sure if it was on YouTube or it might have been over, I was reading about this over on InstaPundit, was speculation about, well, how fast would this thing go? Because if it's using aerodynamics, you could probably, in fact, you might need to actually get it going pretty fast for that to work.
I think it will certainly go faster than a regular blimp.
You're right.
And, I think you can crank it up and get it going faster than and by design, you'd have to go faster than a regular flow, you know, because again, you could stall this thing out and fall. So you have to have some.
It would fall. I mean, it would fall. It would fall much more gradually and gracefully than an airplane.
You know, Phil, as I was reading this, I was reminded of some old pulp science sci-fi. And I was thinking, who wrote that? It was a novel called Beyond the Farthest Star, and in that novel, there were aircraft that were much like our airplanes, but they had shorter wings, and the reason they worked was they had lifting gas in them. And this was Edgar Rice Burroughs back in the early 20th century writing about that idea, and it's fascinating that here we get to see it trotted out in real life here. That concept that he was talking about so many years ago.
How about that? That's like a 100-year-old idea then.
Oh yeah.
Probably.
Yeah.
Amazing. Yeah, I was just now I'm looking at Beyond the Farthest Star, a new interplanetary novel by the creator of Tarzan. Oh, let's see. Actually, written quickly in late 1940. So. Still,
okay.
What's that going to make it, a 75-year-old idea? Impressive. Yeah. What a visionary he was, huh?
Yeah. I loved his novels, especially as a kid, and I've revisited a couple of them as an adult, and they hold up, especially Tarzan and a couple of the others. So, anyway, it's an old idea, the hybrid airships, and I'm glad to see this being developed. And
well, in addition to the coolness of it,
apparently
it solves it's a niche. I mean, there are places that are really hard to get to in the world where there's no infrastructure for taking off and landing an airplane, where a boat can't reach, but you still have activity going on that you want to make happen. And they show, you know, they show some examples of places where you go, oh yeah, I can see where that might make sense. Either where you need to get there sooner, or it's just not a good place to get a boat to, or it's impossible to get a boat to. But this will work, and it's cheaper to fly, according to the obviously this is a marketing promotional thing, this video, but cheaper, a lot cheaper to fly than a conventional aircraft, because presumably to move large freight around, it's going to use a lot less fuel.
You know,
so,
and it also it would not require ground crew
right.
the way a blimp or a dirigible would, because it would land like a conventional airplane, much like a
right.
conventional airplane. It, and so you don't have to have a bunch of guys on the ground, you know, ready to grab the rope that you drop to them, you know, and got, you know, to guide in the blimp. You don't need that. This would land because it's heavier than air. It would land fairly normally, but just in a short, and you know, in a very short space. So it's a cool idea. I'd love to see it develop further, and I hope I wish these guys well.
Me too. And so, I'll tell you why, because this truly could be the self-driving flying car / RV, right? I want one of these kind of on a personal level. Even on a personal level, it'd be pretty big, right? But how
yeah,
fun would
yeah.
that be to have your own one of those? I mean, feel like a Bond villain or something. If you...
Oh, that guy from,
one of those.
And that guy from Contact that never brought his, he lived in a blimp or something like that and never sat down.
Right, exactly. Yeah, you could become that guy. And we all want
yeah.
to be that guy, right? Absolutely. It'd be a lot easier than in an airplane. Well, that's the other thing. It looks like, let's say, okay, I read that the Goodyear blimp flies, clocks out at about 70 miles per hour. I don't know if that's true, but somebody had said that in a comment. So if that's true, that's the fastest you can go in the Goodyear blimp. Let's say this thing can go three times as fast, right? Maybe even faster than that. Who knows? But once you're going 200 miles an hour, that would be, you know, a vehicle like that could be so
yeah.
much more comfortable than a conventional aircraft. You can see where that might actually catch on as a means of transporting people around. I don't know. It might have a shot. Kind of like, you know, some of the charm of riding on a train, only bigger, and also just some of the charm of riding on an airship, which I think a lot of people, that would appeal to a lot of people. So we'll see. I think interesting future for that one. Okay, we're going to run out of time. See, Stephen, we thought we only got five topics. We'll run out of things to say about them. Of course, that never happens to us, does it? How about this story? There is more oil on Titan than on Earth. And my little joke there on the website was, so peak oil is solved at last, right?
Well, there's a couple of and not just by a little bit, Phil. I believe in the article it says that there is like what 100 times more oil on Titan than on Earth.
That's amazing.
That's a lot of oil.
Yeah,
that's a lot of oil. And you know, it
actually says hundreds of times. So.
Hundreds of times. So it's not just 100
yeah.
times. It's 100
no.
with a, of times. More,
yeah.
more oil. Now, here's the crackpot idea that this kind of brings to mind. Okay.
Okay. Good. Finally, a crackpot idea.
Let me. Yeah. You know, we've played it too straight on the show. We need to throw out some crackpot.
Exactly. Let's go a little nuts here.
Okay. There's always been this idea that oil is not the product of geological processes here on Earth, but is the product of life. Right, and therefore that's why we have to be careful. You know, more of this stuff is not being made, and you got to be careful about peak oil, right?
Right.
So either one of two things must be happening on Titan: either geological processes are causing, are creating oil, or caused the oil, or whatever on Titan, or
right,
our chemical processes, or something, or they've got life there. Take your pick. Seems like it would have to be one or the other. What's your thoughts on that, Phil?
You went right to the heart of the issue, as far as I'm concerned. I mean, I was raised with this term fossil fuels, right? When we talk about
right.
coal and oil and natural gas, that these are all products of the biosphere, that, you know, layers and layers of organic matter from, you know, years gone by, previous geological eras, would stack up and they would compress and they turned into, you know, so, I mean, even the old Sinclair Station, right, had the dinosaur as its logo.
Yeah.
Right? It was,
yeah.
Yeah. It was the idea that Yeah, exactly. It took billions of years for these fossil fuels to be created by biological processes, you know, turning into biochemical processes, turning into just chemical processes. And once we use them up, it's all gone because we're never going to create, you know, we're not going to fossilize nearly fast enough for that to happen. Okay, so yeah, now you look at Titan and you go, either on this moon, right, there's some other way of getting them, or boy, there has been a massive amount of life on Titan at some time in the past, right? To have created all this stuff. And I got to go with, you know, for some reason, Occam's razor is telling me that the likelier scenario is that there's just geological processes that can produce this stuff.
Geological processes coupled with some sort of chemistry.
Yeah.
You know, you put enough carbon, you know, in one place and apply, you know, the right processes, and you're going to get this stuff. You're going to get various hydrocarbons, and some of which would burn nicely in an engine. I'm going to have to go. I'm going to have to agree with you, Phil. I thought we were going to go nuts and say, you know, this was once a lush tropical forest at one time, but we went a little less nuts, perhaps, and said, okay, you know what?
Well, I love that theory, but I mean, you think about it. How could it get hundreds of times more than we've got on Earth, right?
Right,
the math just doesn't work. It's like, what did they have going on there in terms of a biosphere that could have possibly produced that much? To me, it's just a real simple math problem. And I know that there has been speculation that, in fact, there may be geological processes that have produced the even on Earth that have produced the so-called fossil fuels that we have, and that is entirely possible that we got that idea wrong initially, or it could be that it works one way on Earth and it works one way someplace else. You know, it's a big universe, and this is just a few planets over. So I mean, there's a lot of possible ways this thing can be sliced, but.
Well, there's,
one of the things
there's,
I wonder
there's
is,
this too, Phil, that we are drilling now for oil at levels and getting oil from levels where we're you know, from below places that life ever had a chance to be.
Right.
We're drilling, you know, below where the biosphere ever was, and getting
case,
oil.
In that case, at the very least, geological processes have moved it. Right. At the very least.
Yeah.
Have moved oil that was created through organic processes. But, yeah, it just seems more likely that at some level our planet is a hydrocarbon factory, and maybe Titan is like a really powerful, efficient
really
hydrocarbon
good
factory. Yeah.
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 I'll go with that.
Here's the question, though. Could we ever access it? Could it do us any good?
Well, it's not a pleasant place to hang out, is it? What's the temperature on Titan?
Well, it's cold enough
that,
you know, those,
high?
179 degrees Celsius. Minus 179 degrees Celsius. So in Fahrenheit,
very
it's
cold.
A whopping 290 below zero. So
yeah.
Instead of water, liquid hydrocarbons in the form of methane and ethane are present on the moon's surface, and tholins probably make up its dunes. The term tholins was coined by Carl Sagan in 1979 to describe the complex organic molecules at the heart of prebiotic chemistry. So it's just this big, super cold soup of organic stuff.
Be gases on Earth, like methane, are rivers and falling as rain. That's fascinating, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I wonder if you could, you know, not that there's a market for it, not that there's any way to get it, but what would Titan be worth, you know? It would be worth all the wealth on Earth, right? I mean, it's,
yeah.
you know, talk about a oil strike. I mean, it's been found, and there it is. But I think you'd have to expend more energy getting there and getting it back than you would get out of the process.
Let's think about this. Now, Titan is a moon of Jupiter, correct? So, it's the first gas giant.
It's Saturn. Excuse me, second.
Okay. So it's a moon of Saturn. So it would be the second gas giant out from us. So it's good plays out there, obviously. But I mean,
yeah.
if you were to mine this stuff with bots, okay, like a army of these things, and it'd be a tough math problem to figure out how to do it. And obviously, it would let's put it out and let it drift home. It would take forever.
Then you got these huge tankers of hydrocarbons re-entering the atmosphere. You got to be real careful with that.
You wouldn't want to do that. You'd find uses for them out in space. You wouldn't want to bring it home. Because like you say, let's re-enter with this stuff and hope for the best. Let's keep our fingers.
Yeah, let's just hope for the best. You talk about an oil spill. Oh my God. Yeah. I think by the time you figured out the technology for doing all that, you would have sufficiently advanced technology to enable lots of other ways of getting energy.
True.
You know, but to me this is very encouraging. It's like, okay, well, good. So if the aliens ever come, you know, looking for our resources, right? Especially if they need hydrocarbons. You know, if they come to the solar system, they're going to go straight to Titan, right? Yeah, they're not going to mess with us at all. So at least we got that going for us. I feel good about that. Okay, we got to keep moving.
But if Mars needs women, we got a problem. Okay, moving. Anyway.
All right.
Okay,
we're doing fine on time. Come to think of it. This next one really got my attention. Brain-to-text systems converts speech brainwave patterns to text. And this was over on Kurzweil, Accelerating Intelligence. And it's not like we haven't seen stories like this before, because we have. But every time we see one of these, what's interesting to me about this is we get a little farther along with this sort of thing than we were before. Okay, so here's the setup. You got people with EEGs, wired to their heads, okay? You got a machine reading their brainwaves, and they're reading text out loud. And the EEG output is being looked at by computers that are running powerful machine learning programs, okay? This powerful artificial intelligence for pattern recognition, machine learning, figuring out, you know, what a pattern is. And this is obviously what you call a trained machine learning. Obviously, you have to guide them as to what, you know, an input looks like and an output looks like. But with a little bit of guidance, these machine learning algorithms are able to read brain waves coming off an EEG and convert them back into text. Okay, so basically, the text that the person reading out loud. It's not like the machine is hearing it and transcribing those words to text. The machine is reading the EEG waves corresponding to what they're thinking as they're saying those words, and it's turning those back into text. And the text is a pretty good match. The system achieves word error rate. Go ahead.
And so this is, you know, much simpler to do than to try to hack directly into the brain. And certainly that, you know, non-invasive is a plus, isn't it? You don't have to drill
Absolutely.
A hole in somebody's head to do something like this. Well, you were about to say, what's the error rate?
Says as low as 25%. And phone, which is instances of phonemes and utterances, error rates below 50%. So that means, okay, as low as 25%, that sounds really bad. But if you remember what optical character recognition software worked like 15, 20 years ago, that was about right, you know? It's like every third or fourth word would be wrong. it wouldn't get it right. We're on an arc here, okay, where this is going to improve exponentially fast. And
imagine they're
already below 50% of getting, like, if you say it was a fair day and we went to the fair, right? It's taking the context and it's getting it wrong less than half the time. That's what that phone thing means, okay? So even at this very early stage, three-quarters of the time it's getting the right word, and even if the word is, identical, I guess, in terms of brain pattern, it's smart enough by context to figure out which is which a little more than half the time. So, you know, not bad, I think.
Well, you know, imagine how awesome this would be for Stephen Hawking. You know, the system that Stephen Hawking uses now is pretty low tech in a way. It involves him looking in a certain direction, and the movement of his eyes, you know, can allow him to type, and it's really slow. And so much of what he does to communicate is pre-typed or, you know, prepared in advance, okay, so that, you know, he has canned responses to a lot of things. But imagine how awesome something like this would be. Allow him to be able to, you know, have a more normal conversation with people, and you know, so it would help those, you know, people that are kind of locked in a way, or have other medical problems to communicate. It's fantastic.
It's and not just communicate. You think about it. It's the ability to direct machines, right? I mean, it's not if the great thing is anything that can be turned into a signal that a computer can read can be turned into a signal that can tell a computer to do something. And computers run everything anymore. So, you know, you're talking about essentially, a process by which someone who is quadriplegic, someone who is incapacitated, can't talk, you know, lacks the motor skills to do some of the things that are required for some of these really ingenious interfaces they've come up with up to this point to help people like that. But this is like the ultimate skipping a step, right? It doesn't matter what's wrong with your body. If your brain still works, this is the way out, right? This is the thing that's going to work. This is the thing that will allow a person to communicate or to make their wheelchair go, you know, or turn a light on or access the internet. I mean, the applications of that are endless. And I'm pleased, Stephen, that you went right there, because I want to tell you, I was giving a little preview of the show to my family this evening, and my wife immediately gave the old, you know, there's people dying of cancer in the world. Why would they work on something like, you know, reading, turning brainwaves to text when they could be doing something to help people? And I immediately said, well, have you thought about this? This has tremendous medical applications, and I think that those alone are reasons for pursuing that research. However, there are applications far beyond helping out the infirm, aren't there?
Right, and it would be the sort of thing that would help expand the abilities of even able-bodied and able, you know, fully capable people would be able to, Phil. I mean, you might be able to think things faster than you can do it any other way, you know. So you could be directing your robot army to be doing your bidding, you know, with something like this.
I do a lot of writing for my work, and a lot of the time I'm on the keyboard, but a lot of the time I get my iPhone out and use the dictation feature on the plain text pad. Because I can talk faster than I can type a lot of the times. And it's good enough now that, the little bit of cleanup that I have to do is still faster than my keyboarding, okay? Which, you know, my keyboarding is sometimes faster, sometimes slower, but sometimes it's just in this mode where I'd rather just say it, you know? And so I talk through it, and then I've got text that I can edit. Well, you know what? I know I can think faster than I can talk. So I start thinking about, you know, just the most basic of computer functions. I mean, one of the reasons that people bought computers in the first place is the word processor. And even if we're not talking about mind reading or, you know, telepathy or, you know, sending messages, you know, from one brain to the next, just thinking text onto the screen, which sounds like this crazy, almost fantasy, not even science fiction kind of scenario, is completely implied by this research. And I think, you know, I think we'll see applications like that in the fairly near future. The big roadblock is not getting from 75% to 99%, that'll happen almost naturally, right? That's just, that's Moore's law. I mean, that's just what happens with software. I think the real trick is what's happening with hardware right now, what's happening with sensors. You know, there's kind of this revolution going on with sensors around Internet of Things. You want a really effective, really sensitive, really powerful EEG that's completely invisible and innocuous, right? I mean, if you're going to have this kind of interface with your computer, you don't want to be putting on that. Remember the mind reading machine that Doc Brown has on when Marty shows up at his house in Back to the Future? Right?
Put the plunger on his head, and says, you're part of the Naval Youth Auxiliary.
Exactly. Yeah. You don't want that thing.
No, you don't want
head.
That. You don't want that thing.
Yeah. You want something that you don't even realize you're putting on your head. You know, that's just finding its way in, and that is a lot more sensitive than what we currently have. But I actually think that hardware interface will probably be one of the biggest challenges to overcome. But once you have it, you know, the sky is the limit. The people are going to rapidly go from automatically thinking about typing to talking. I mean, you see it happening a lot now. You see people talking into their phones. They're giving them instructions, right? They're running, you know, programs or sending messages and things like that. People are going to go very rapidly from typing to talking, and even faster from talking to thinking. I think it's really going to become the way we interact with machines. And to go back to your robot army, Stephen. That really is where it takes you. Not necessarily a robot army, but ultimately it opens up a whole new way for all of us to interact with, yes, data, but machines control everything, so it opens up this whole new way to interact with the world. Maybe before we have the self-driving car, we'll have the you-don't-have-to-touch-anything car, right? You can just, you know, think your way through the through the traffic. I don't know. Maybe there would be no advantage to that, and people won't like it. But I can see people playing video games where they're not touching anything, right? They're just thinking at it. Or maybe thinking becomes a, you know, like an added part of doing things. So you could be typing and thinking at the same time, right? Or you know how, like, do you ever play pinball?
Yeah.
So you know how part of it is hitting the flippers and part of it is kind of shaking the machine?
Yeah.
Imagine if there were games that were that.
You'd tilt.
What's that?
But not too much, or you'll tilt the machine.
Exactly. There could be games that would work exactly that way, right? So you're on the joystick and you're making one thing happen, and you're thinking and you're making something else happen. Anyway, I think the applications here are endless, and they really speak to opening up a whole new chapter in how we're going to interact not only with data, but ultimately with each other and with the world. So I don't think you can underestimate the significance of this. You know, where we saw something like this before, it was a few years ago, and they were matching up, I believe it was EEG scans of people looking at pictures, right, and then recreating the pictures. Here we're seeing something very similar, and they're doing it with text. I don't know how far
Think would be an easier nut to crack, actually, than the reproducing a picture. This might be easier.
Well, and, you know, I know why they went that way, because machine learning, neural networks have been dedicated to solving problems around vision, solving problems around graphics. It's, you know, it's the graphical processing units, the GPUs, that's why they were invented, was to do that thing. So I know why that's why they went there first. But now, yeah, maybe they've taken a step back and said, well, wait a minute, text is maybe easier just in terms
and
of
power.
Yeah, and it's so powerful. There's so much that you can do with it, and they'll wait a generation or two of the technology, and then they'll come back and they'll be able to do the pictures too. That's what's happening in the neighborhood with brain to text, and I got to tell you, I think that this is just the sort of thing. It's the sort of story that shows up on Kurzweil, and it gets, you know, whatever notice it gets among the community, and people look at it and think about it. But this is really huge. This is really, you know, to borrow the name of our show, this is world-transforming kind of stuff going on here.
Imagine a world where we're altering our environment just by thinking about it. It's and in meaningful ways we're altering the environment around ourselves. just by thinking how it should be altered.
Right.
You know, as you're walking outside, the car pulls around. You know, you think I need to make sure all the lights are off in the house, and all the lights go off in the house.
And they might as well
have the air conditioner not run while I'm gone, and of course the house responds that way. And you know, it's just all these things that you know we normally have to think. You know, got to do while we're there. It's the smart house, but it's a step further. It's the house that is smart with you. It's more of an extension of yourself than it operating autonomously. Which in a way, if it's operating autonomously, it may not be operating exactly the way you want it to. But if it's connected with you and it's attuned to what you're thinking, then it's not just a smart house, but it's also an extension of your very self in a way. And it's
exactly.
That's,
how you've said in the past that you look at Google as kind of an extension of your own mind. Here's a technology that makes kind of the world an extension of your mind, basically. Ultimately,
the world an extension of your body, because we think of our physical selves as this body. Well, if you can alter the world just with the power of thought, and from a distance, then it begins to feel like you're reaching out across, you know. And of course, telephones and things like this have been doing stuff like that for years. But this is you're doing physical things just with the power of thought. The same way, I'm making a fist with my hand. Well, you could make the fist with a robot hand across the planet with a system like this. So. It's incredibly powerful, and the word we're dancing
around here is magic. Okay, it's like you've got magic powers. I mean, that's really
that's right. Mm-hmm.
That's the closest analogy I think from human understanding that you can bring it to. This is sufficiently advanced technology that to even people from a few years ago it would be, in Arthur C. Clarke's word, indistinguishable from magic. That's how powerful of a set of effects we're talking about. Okay, we're almost out of time. And we've got this one other one that I saw. It was just above the story about the brain scan at Kurzweil, and it was, does a black hole create a hologram copy of anything that touches it? And here's what I'm going to say, okay, because I had that little quip on the show description that said, and if so, how can we get rich from this? This one is too dense for us to try to tackle. So we're gonna push this one off and pick it up either next week or with another show. Did you get a chance to read it at all?
It's too dense. I read it, Phil, but I don't understand it. Probably a good thing.
I understand the headline, and that's dangerous, right? It's like, okay, well, the headline sounds great. Touch something with a black hole, and you get another.
Hey, give me a week to grasp the quantum physics behind this, Bill. I need at least a week. Come on.
Okay, so we'll read over this, and we'll see if there's anything for us to talk about here or not. Exactly. A week should do, right? Actually, if you can get it down in 5 days, that gives you one day or two to explain it to me. That would be perfect.
There we go. Okay.
All right. Well, Stephen, what's our music?
Our music tonight is Breathe by Bellevue.
Bellevue with Breathe. All right. Well, thanks, Stephen, for putting that together. Great talking with you. Great being back on the show. Thank you all for being with us. We will be back again next week with another all-new show. And until next time, live to see it.